Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be bringing home the bacon. John O'Bacon's going to be joining us to talk about the evolution of community. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett, episode 462, recorded December 6th, 2017, Evolution of Community. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name with Hover and build your online brand today. Go to hover.com/twit and save 10% off your first purchase. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with. Today is not a project. Today is more about a person, a very wonderful, good friend of mine, John O'Bacon. John O's going to be joining us in just a few minutes to talk about the art of community and the evolution of community. So, that's what I was trying to do next. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan.
Hey, it's good to be here once again. Not on fire. I'm in the flyover state of Oklahoma. Has a benefit today of not being overtaken by a wildfire.
Yeah, and I'm in Santa Monica, and the fire is just right over there. It's actually causing my eyes to burn and my throat to hurt and everything. So I may be going home quickly, not right after the show, but real soon. Maybe as early as Friday, I might be heading out of here just to keep from going crazy. Anyway, so as I was saying moments ago, John O'Bacon wrote a seminal book in 2007 called The Art of Community and set up a whole practice and organization around it, started holding community leadership summits at various conferences, and has really, really been giving advice, learning about community, teaching about community. His biggest, well, when I first met him, he was the community manager, community leader for the Ubuntu, which was really fascinating too. So he's had a lot of experience doing this. In fact, I could read his whole credits and it would take up about half the show. So I'm not going to do that. I'll let him say whatever he wants to say about himself. Jonathan, what do you know about John O?
I am familiar with him from having followed Floss Weekly way back in the day. It was Flossing with Bacon for a little while because John O was hosting or co-hosting. I remember several episodes that he was involved in, so I've gotten to know him through that.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even mention that he was also the co-host on this show, occasionally even subbing in for me. But that's back 10 years ago, 9 years ago, when Leo was actually still the host and main producer. I've sort of taken over that role starting about, I think, 7 years ago, somewhere in there. It's been too long already. Anyway, we don't want to waste any of his precious time, so this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Hover. What are you passionate about? Do you have an idea for a business? Are you launching a creative project? Buying a domain name is the first and biggest step to building your brand online. Hover has over 400 domain extensions to choose from to help you brand yourself. That's a lot of choices to help you find the perfect domain name. If you're a blogger or a company trying to create new leads or inform your customer base, you can use .blog instead of a generic .com or .biz domain name. By using .blog, you're telling everyone to expect impactful content about your topic or business rather than a generic homepage. Whatever your interests may be, Hover has an extension for you. .tech, .photo, .security. And you know what else is great about Hover? Best-in-class customer support and no upsells. The Hover Connect feature allows you to connect your domain name to any host or website builder with a few simple clicks. Personalized email that matches your domain and further supports your online identity. Show the online community who you are and what you're passionate about. Go to hover.com/twit and get 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com/twit. And we thank Hover for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our very, very special guest, John O'Bacon. John O, welcome back to the show.
How you doing? It's good to be back. It's been a while.
I know. I'm doing great. I was so impressed by your keynote talk. I think it was at All Things Open or maybe the Red Hat Summit, one of those, I think. Where you talked about community and even how it's evolved over time. just start riffing. What do you want to talk about here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, do you want to talk about metal? I'm really into metal.
No.
I'm talking about whatever you want.
I'll actually give you a question here. Let's start with it this way. Okay. You've been involved in community building now and teaching about community and actually doing it as your profession for many years now. And The question I had to you right after you gave your keynote was, how has community changed in the time frame that you were doing this?
Yeah.
What's evolved?
Yeah, I mean, I started out, you know, getting interested in this in, I think, about 1998, and then which is when I got interested in Linux and open source. And I didn't really start working professionally until about 2002. In my mind, where it's evolved significantly is back in, particularly in those earlier days, no one really knew what they were doing. So everybody was trying to figure out, you know, how to kind of get people interested and involved and how to incentivize people. And, you know, of course, people tried things that worked and people tried things that didn't work. And I think what's happened in the last 10 years or so is that the awareness and the knowledge of which of these things work and which of these things don't work has become much more formalized. Part of the reason why I wrote, I remember when I moved to the US in 2008, one of the things that I don't know what had happened, but something had struck me around that time that, you know, this whole community building lark offers a huge amount of value for companies, but there really isn't any body of knowledge that can help guide people with what to do. And I don't profess to be, an expert and have all of the answers on this kind of stuff. But I wanted to, one, write a book, which is what The Art of Community was, two, start a conference to bring community managers together, which is what the Community Leadership Summit is. And then three was to, for me to just expose myself to as many different types of organizations as possible. Like back then I'd already been working primarily in open source. And the writing of the book actually led to that because then people started reaching out about consultancy and I started working with like financial services institutions and things like that, which I had no idea about.
Wow.
And since then, I think what we've seen is community management and developer relations and things like that has become an actual role in companies. Like when I took my role at Canonical in 2006, I'd never heard the term community manager before. The first time I'd ever heard of it was from Mark Shuttleworth. And now, of course, community management is a thing that lots of people do. So I think like anything, it's kind of like, you know, in the early days of, you know, like with the Renaissance is when, you know, those kind of like, those disciplines became formalized. I think we've seen that particularly in the last 10 years with community as applied to technology.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in doing this show for 10 years now is that the organizations and projects that have actually specifically brought on someone called a community manager have definitely grown much more rapidly and are also apparently a lot more aware of the impact that open source is in both directions, both towards the company that originated the product and towards the shared uses and building ons and standing on the shoulders of. Can you speak a little bit to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, this is something I've learned a lot about since I started consulting. So I started consulting full time just under a couple of years ago. But I've been doing it on the side for years. And one of the things from not just working within, you know, a single company, as most of us do when you've got a job, I just realized that lots and lots of people saw similar types of value, which is, better engagement with your users or your customers, brand recognition, you know, production of whether it's software or whether it's material or support. So like tangible value. But then, of course, it becomes like more specific depending on the industry. So in open source, we see a lot of technology production, right? If you're a company, you've got an open source project, or you've got a platform where people build extensions or modules, then people build technology and it benefits your overall offering, right? More and more people start using it. Whereas if you are, for example, in the financial services world, like I mentioned, then the value of community is primarily about optimizing how people work together and reducing silos. Like one company, for example, that I work with, which is a large bank, we're building a community inside that company. And nothing will ever go beyond the walls of that company. So for them, it's not an outreach. It's not a public thing. It's not the benefit of, you know, it has no benefit to their customers. that's all about helping the company to work as efficiently as possible, and community is a tool in accomplishing that. Because otherwise, if you don't do that, you basically get people stuck in their little, you know, cubicles, locked in their silos, and then one, the left hand can't talk to the right hand. So to me, I see it in two layers. You've got that like underlying layer that basically applies to everybody, which frankly is sat on a lot of psychology. And increasingly in recent years, I've become a bit of a psychology buff. I'm nowhere near as experienced as an actual, you know, like someone, a student of psychology. But for me, psychology provides a set of guardrails or a scaffolding for understanding that layer. And then what sits on top of that, which is primarily the execution and the tactics piece, that's more specific to the different industries.
So I see you've released a second edition of your Art of Community book. What things changed in the how far apart was it? Like 8 years or so apart?
No, the second edition actually came out a couple of years after the first edition. The first edition was just me trying to document what was in my head. And I say at the beginning, like, you know, I don't profess to have all the answers. This is just what I've learned. And one of the things I love about this, like a lot of things, is I learn something from people every single day. Like, you know, it's a thrill understanding what works and what doesn't work. The second edition was basically stuff I'd learned in that 2 year period. I also added a bunch of interviews with people. So you're people who I respect. So, you know, I'd included some content like that in the first edition, but in the second edition, I interviewed like Linus Torvalds, obviously creator of Linux, Martin Mikos, who now runs HackerOne, but used to be the CEO of MySQL, Mike Shinoda, who's the one of the co-founders of the band Linkin Park, various other people. Just to kind of add a bit more kind of texture to that. I have to say, my book it's a bit of a blessing and a curse, because on one hand, a lot of people say, he wrote the book in Community. And I like to say, he wrote a book in Community. but one of the downsides of it is that it kind of like crystallizes your experience at that time. And the second edition came out in 2012, I think it was. Okay. So it's been 5 years. And I've learned so much in 5 years that some of that stuff that I, in the second edition, I'd probably take out, and I'd add a load of extra stuff. But you know, then you got to find the time to write another edition. So, you know, you'll know what I'm talking about, Randall. I mean, you've done this before.
There's only so many nights and weekends. I mean, everybody keeps asking me, why don't I write another book? And I keep saying, because I don't want to keep working for minimum wage. I have other things to do, you know, unless your name is Grisham or something, you know, you're not going to make a living off of these things, really. It gets you into the door, but it never gets you a lot more money. Yeah. So,
it's important, I think, to kind of burst the bubble of prospective authors from time to time. Like the amount of people who've said, you know, I'm really thinking about writing a book about this. And I'll always say to them, like, and someone said this to me when I wrote my first book, I forget who it was, but they said, you know, no matter how hard you think it is writing that book, it's going to be twice as hard.
Yes. And take twice as long and more nights and weekends than you think. Yeah. It's crazy. So let's talk about one specific topic that I'm sure has really changed the landscape for community. Social media. How has social media impacted community? And in that, I mean, both in the sense of how open source communities are furthered by social media, and even commercial communities are furthered by social media and having a good social media presence. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. Social media is interesting to me because I think a lot of people look at it as a, you know, this lightning rod that will build a community for you. Like if you do social media right, then the hordes will show up, and that social media is this big, you know, special, complicated thing that we should focus on. To me, it's a tool. It's nothing more than that. I think there are ways of doing social media well, and there are ways of not doing it well. So I tend to look at it from two angles. One is content, and then the second angle is growth. So like a lot of people, all they focus on is growth, and they focus on getting as many Twitter followers as they can and things such as that. That is a complete waste of time. No one cares if you've got 100,000 Twitter followers. You know, if all of them are Russian bots, then who cares? What I care more about is what I would say are qualified followers. So if I'm building growth for a client, I'm focused on, I'd rather them have 100 people who actually care about what the company's doing than 100,000 people who are never reading that material. That's one of the reasons why a good way of looking at this is if someone follows you, they have 35,000 followers and they're following 35,000 people, then they are basically gaming the system. Like, that's how it works. If someone's got 35,000 followers and they've got 1,000 followers, then it's, you know, then it's different. So I think it's got to be authentic. And that's tricky for big companies, because I worked with one company once. There was a tweet went through 6 to 10 rounds of review before it went out there, which is absolutely ridiculous, you know, for 140 characters on now 200 and whatever it is. you know,
280.
Yeah, social media needs to be, it's like all communication. It needs to be human. It needs to be engaging, and it needs to be real. Like, the, you know, no one likes looking at corporate tweets, and there's this perception in the world that the bigger the company becomes, the more corporate company becomes, that their messaging has to become less flavorful and less interesting. And I think companies who buck that trend are the ones that people like to follow. That's one of the reasons why one of the people I'm a big fan of this is the CEO of T-Mobile, this guy called John Laguerre. And he, when he gives talks, he's cursing and effing and planting, you know. Wow. And his view is, he says, I want to speak like my customers. My customers speak like this. My customers don't use the word enterprise in every sentence. I'm not suggesting that that we do that in social media, but it's got to be real. From a content perspective, there's loads and loads of ways in which you can optimize it as well. One of the downsides I think a lot of people approach with social media is that more is more. So they just blast out stuff left, right, and center. And I think for personal accounts, that's fine. Like, and it, like when someone takes a picture of their salad at Applebee's and puts it up on Twitter, no one cares. Like, literally no one cares, right? And people, if you'd start doing stuff like that as a company, they care less. In fact, it incenses people. Like, if I go and post a picture of my son and put it on Twitter, then my friends will say, that's cool. But if you do that, if you start posting minutiae from a corporate account, then you actually end up driving people away. So it's a really delicate balance. But, you know, I think that's another thing that I think we're still figuring out. But the main thing that I would have, without sounding like a curmudgeon, is it's a tool. It's not, I don't even see it as necessarily like a significant tool. It's just one feather in the bow that we use.
Hey, Jono. It's Jonathan. Great to finally meet you in person and talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, Jono.
I wanted to ask you, you seem to be focusing on this idea of established businesses that are growing a community. What about when you have a community that's established around an open source project, maybe one that's more to scratch someone's itch, that then is being used by a business later, or maybe even starting their own business? How does that change this idea of community? And how the community grows?
Yeah. It's a really good question. And I think it gets to the heart of the nuance with a lot of open source projects. I think one of the tricky things in the open source world is you get this situation where you've got, you know, open source projects, volunteer projects, where the output of those projects will be benefiting a commercial organization, or there may be people from a commercial organization feeding into that project and adding value to that project. And we had this a lot when I was at Canonical. You know, you've got the company Canonical who needs to sell stuff to stay in business, and then you've got the Ubuntu project. To me, one of the most important things to do here to get this balance right is to, and I know I keep using the word value, but I think that's where it fundamentally pans out, is to, when constructing the community, is to first of all define the personas of the people that you want involved in it. So you say, okay, well, we want developers, or we want documentation writers or translators, whatever it might be. And then for each of those individuals, you define what is the personal value that one of those contributors, a volunteer, will get out of participating in the community. And then separately, you define what is the value to the company that you want to derive from this. So the challenge with a lot of organizations who build communities is that they primarily look at it from the value that's driven for the company. So what happens then is you build a community that seems really interesting to the company, but no one really wants to join because it just doesn't offer enough interest or value for for the individual to participate. So defining those core drivers up front, I think, is valuable, and then that then leading to the tactics of how you do that. So, for example, if we understand that for an individual, a volunteer participating in an open source project, they want to write software that makes a difference, that's meaningful. They want to improve their own experience, and they want to have fun. Well, the very common elements with a lot of open source projects. If I was an organization who was investing in that community, either I run the community, I'm a participant, I'd want to make sure that my participation ultimately serves those areas. So I'd want to make sure that my engagement is really fun and loose in how I engage with other people in the community. I'd want to, as I participate, to be able to be as useful to other people in terms of how they can further their own experience and participation, such as code review or sharing tips and tricks or, you know, mentoring or something like that. So that to me is the key thing. The tricky thing here is that there is so much nuance in open source that I've been in the open source community now, probably not as long as you guys, but since 1998. So what, 20 odd years? And I don't understand all the nuance of this, let alone people who have just joined up. And I think that's where people get into sticky situations a little bit. That's why I think understanding those drivers is so critical.
So we do have, obviously, the chat room. And someone in the chat room just asked the best follow-up question. Tech Dino, what is the best company right now for implementing what you just described? Who's doing it the best right now?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there's a bunch of companies who are doing really good stuff with communities. Just a couple of examples. I think Google has done a really nice job, pretty broadly. One of the people I work with actually is the guy who runs all of their developer relations at Google. And they've got so many different teams and so many different projects. And they take a really thoughtful approach to how they do this. So I definitely say Google. From a pure open source perspective, I think Endless Mobile, or Endless Computing, who are building the Endless OS, are doing a really good job. Red Hat, for many, many years, have been active and effective members of the open source community, particularly with upstreams, I would say. I think they're doing a really good job. Let me think who else. Facebook do some really interesting stuff in terms of how they've built out their community as well. I'll be honest with you, there are not that many organizations that I can count where they do it, in my mind, in the way I would like to see them do it. Like, I like to look at community as a journey where you define those personas, you build on ramps, you break people into new regulars and core, and then you incentivize people to move them forward. And I still think a lot of companies that are approaching it from a somewhat haphazard approach, but that's becoming more and more formalized as the industry kind of moves on. So yeah, it's all getting good.
And then there have been some examples of community going very badly. Have you watched some of those? I won't mention any names, although I could. But there have been some examples where mismanagement of community or even problems within the community have threatened to destroy somebody's project. And have you watched those? And what are some of the lessons we can learn from those situations?
It's tricky. As a general rule, I always try to take the long view. I think there are always, I think as society progresses, particularly now, we've become such a reactionary society. And talking about social media, I largely blame social media for this, because I think social media has turned us into people who want a quick fix. You get a tweet every second, and then you move on to the next one. And I worry that long form thought is being sacrificed a little bit in this. So when I look at organizations who are having problems with their community, where the community's not happy or there's been mistakes made, and we won't mention any names, I try to look at the intentions of what that organization is doing and the intentions of the community. And in many cases, those intentions are aligned, but the execution of those intentions are different. So, one of the tricky things here is if you find a company that seems to be not being open and transparent, is not engaging with their community, is not being reactive to feedback, things such as that, I think invariably what tends to happen in these situations is the company always has more information. So they understand the customers, they understand the marketplace, they understand the people involved in building it. So when they see kind of like apparent criticism that's happening in the community, it's easy to just reject it and to say, you know what, those people, they benefit from the stuff that we produce and they're moaning about it. Like, how dare they, you know? And to me, that's the wrong way to look at it. I think the company that in that kind of situation, they want to drive value and they understand the value of the community. But what they don't do is they don't look at it from the shoes of somebody else. And again, more broadly, I would say that lots of people do this without kind of descending this into politics. One of the things that drives me nuts about the current political climate is that people are more interested in picking sides than actually having a conversation and understanding other people. So you get people on the left wing who immediately assume that people are on the right wing are a certain way, and people on the right wing immediately assume that people are on the left wing are a certain way. And people are more interested in taking pot shots than actually sitting down and saying, well, let's try and understand their viewpoint and let's try and understand what the driver is and how we can build a connection to them. And we see this when these kind of community spats tend to happen. The same thing happens on the community side of things. You know, it's easy for people to point the finger towards the organization. But what typically happens as well from the community perspective is it's easy to say, in the same way that a company will always have more information, it's easy to suggest that in the community, if you don't have the right information, you can make it up effectively, right? So if you see a certain type of activity happening from the company, it's easy to assume the drivers behind that. And in many cases, the drivers in all of these things are very, very different. So I'm my general guidance here and what I share with my clients in these kind of conflict scenarios is, you know, like seek to understand, first of all, objectively, like put your biases to one side, put your views to one side, put all of what's happened to one side and try to paint an objective picture of what the other view is. And then try to look at how you can accomplish what you want in a way that brings benefit to that other view. If you don't do that, it just becomes a slinging match, and it doesn't grow.
Well, I know you don't have much time left, but we did want to get to two final topics. One is at least, well, by the way, just to follow up on that last segment you just did, I've invented the term a few years ago, pitchforks, for the projects that have been forked hostily. Feel free to use it.
I like it.
Yeah. And we could rattle off about 20 between the two of us already. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to waste time doing that. But I do want to say I found that Art of Community book is a really good read. It's excellent in this area. And I just wanted you to be able to plug that it's actually available for free under a very liberal license online. Except I just plugged it. So there we go.
So it's just one quick note. It's published by O'Reilly, so you can go and buy it in bookstores. You can get it on Amazon, places like that, in print. Like Randall says, you can also download it. You know, I really wanted to make sure that people who couldn't afford to buy it could get it. And yes. O'Reilly were very, very open to that. O'Reilly are great when it comes to publishing books for free. So, yeah, go get the PDF.
Absolutely. And what's the most unusual thing that has happened that you've observed or that you've discovered at one of your community leadership summits?
The most unusual thing, I guess it depends whether we're at the summit or in the bar.
That's the hallway track. You might as well talk about that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably one of the most unusual things that from the community leadership summit that I experienced was there was an incident, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was, where an individual was boycotting OSCON and the Community Leadership Summit due to an alleged incident that happened at one of the events. And And basically, they said, you know, there's no code of conduct on the OSCON website. There's no code of conduct on the Community Leadership Summit website. I heard about this at 6 o'clock in the morning on the Saturday morning while I'm setting up for CLS, and I, you know, I can't speak for OSCON. I know the OSCON organizers, and I know who the people who run the event, and they're lovely people. But in terms of CLS, which is an independent event, the lack of a code of conduct was just a complete oversight. I just had forgotten to put it up there. This was back when, like now, a code of conduct is kind of like a given with events, right? This was back before it was so normal. So I just took 2 minutes and I went and took a copy of the Ubuntu code of conduct, which we'd went through a process putting together, put it onto the CLS website and went to the blog post and said, I'm really sorry, complete oversight, didn't realize. It's there now. And three or four people showed up that morning. And the individual in question who said that she was going to boycott the event and, you know, came up to me after my keynote that morning and said, you know, we're really, really thankful, really appreciative that you did this and blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And the thing I said to them was, you know what? Thank you. That's great. But it's not going to I don't think it's going to solve the problem. You know, here's the thing. Don't read codes of conduct. Okay.
Right.
They just behave that way. The way in which we change behavior, the way in which we change the quality of conduct to these conferences is through lots of different ways. It's going to be leadership and it's going to be what we tolerate inside and outside the event, things like that. This to me is just a start. So the thing that kind of struck me as weird there was that the code of conduct was, you know, the solution. And to me, it was one piece of the puzzle. And that was just kind of a little odd to me at the time. That's probably the weirdest thing that we've ever had. CLS doesn't have a lot of weird stuff that happens, really. Well, we had one person get up and do geek stand-up comedy, which was weird, but she was quite funny. So
it helps when they're funny. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, she was good. She was very good. Yeah.
And you've only got a couple minutes. Can you give us an overview of what happens at the CLS?
Yeah. So basically, it's an event where community managers from all kinds of different industries, but primarily open source, get together. For 2 days, it's complete. It's very informal. It's an unconference, so it's discussion sessions. We have a few keynotes in the morning. I do an intro. We have a few keynotes, and then we get off into sessions and have conversations. And we basically try to evolve the art of community management and leadership. And it happens before the OSCON event each year. I'm just finalizing the specifics with the event for 2018. So I'm hoping to announce that quite soon. It's completely free to attend. It was in Austin for the last 2 years, and every other year before that was in Portland. And we're back to Portland in 2018, which I'm really excited about. I love Austin,
Yay.
But Portland's like a second home for me. So, So that's it.
Portland's our first home for me. So, yes.
You don't get to travel then.
Yeah, I just get to drive down the street. That's going to be pretty simple. I'll take an Uber or something like that. Jono, I'm sorry we're running out of time. You have a hard out and take a call, but at least you can come on for a little while and talk about this. We could have gone on for another 2 hours talking about these topics. So maybe we'll have you on again in the near future. We'll have more time to kind of be, you know, work through this. So thank you very much, Jono. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Before we get a little further into the show, I do have another ad to read because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the ones that are just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. So let's talk a little bit about what we just talked about with Jono. So I really like that there was way more information that we could cover in the half hour we were able to have with him. But was there anything that stood out for you as we were doing the show?
Sure. So there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, first off, we could talk about this for. I wish we'd had him for the next 30 minutes because there were some other things I really wanted to ask him about. But it's interesting to think about this idea of community and governance and how there's a bunch of different communities that do it differently. And so, you know, you've got Ubuntu, who has, you know, multiple people leading it and working. But then you have something like the Linux kernel that has one guy at the top, you know, benevolent dictator for life. And I find it really interesting that there are these different ways to do community and to do a project, but yet, you know, different communities have made it work. Randall, what are your thoughts as far as these different ways of doing community? What have you seen that, you know, works well, doesn't work?
Well, you know, over the 10 years I've been doing Floss Weekly, it's one of the things I've seen is lots and lots of different models of how typically it's a product-driven business that now wants to say we're open source. And so the degree to which they can spin that dial over to becoming an open source organization really affects the way the community grows up around it. Because if they want to retain control of the roadmap, have their repos in private and maybe publish once a quarter, things like that, there's a lot of ways you can really damage a community that wants to get involved, you know, maybe not accepting pull requests, maybe having your bug tracker in private, things like that. A lot of these just don't work when you're trying to build community. The community needs to be able to participate. That's why we often ask of the guests here, you know, how much of the commits are coming from internal to the company versus how many are coming from outside. And then we ask that question very specifically because I want to see how far along they've gotten on community development. I also see sometimes that when I'm not speaking to a community coordinator, I usually prefer that when I'm talking to people here on Floss. When I'm instead speaking to the CEO or the CTO, not that there's anything wrong with people at that level, they tend to have a different view about what they're on the show for, and they haven't thought about these community questions sometimes. But if it's a community coordinator, I really enjoy that because I know I'm going to be talking to somebody who really gets it and can really really put it out there.
That's an interesting opportunity, though, to be able to take a CEO or a CTO and provoke them to think about some of these questions. Have we ever had that before where someone hasn't thought about it, but we really provoke them to think about, well, maybe I need to do more with the community?
There's not a lot I can do in a 45-minute interview, so we're kind of stuck every once in a while. Also, I try not to ambush anybody on this show. I've been very, very careful about that I respect the person for being and taking their time, no matter where they are along that scale. And I tell you, we've had them at both ends. You know, I sometimes joke in the chat room, our private chat room, that I'm about to channel Simon Phipps, of course, one of the co-hosts of the show, because I start looking at it and see, is this just a freemium model? Is this just a lost lead? Of the sort of the basic, like a trial edition, is that all you get for open source? And if so, why are they on this show? But if I don't find that out until they're midway in the show, it's kind of like, now what do I do? Okay, I've got to still fill the rest of the 45 minutes with something interesting about their project. So I kind of just roll with it. I do remember. I don't remember the actual project, but I do remember that I suggested that more of their product be open source to make it a little more useful. And they said they're looking at it. But I don't remember. It was like about a year ago, year and a half ago. And I'm not going to go back and watch all the tapes, you know. So it's not like I've got that kind of time handy. So I did want to talk a little bit about contributing to open source, though, because Jono touched on it just for a second there. And I thought I could follow up on it more directly. But contributing to open source doesn't always mean you have to be a coder. You don't have to be the one actually writing the software. You could help with the documentation. You could report bugs. Even reporting bugs is useful, or feature requests. Because if developers are pretty much focused, if this is like a scratching our own itch kind of project, developers are going to be focused on the things that they need. But if this one extra feature that would really make a difference for you, you could just put a bug request in or a feature request, or even better, code it. But you know, if you're not a coder, like I'm saying, there's lots of things you can do otherwise. So there's lots and lots of ways to contribute to open source. Talking about it, setting up meetups. You know, Perl meetups, the original Perlmongers meetings, were a real great way of building community for the Perl community because it was a place you could go and see that you're not the only person coding in Perl in your city. That you were that you know, where you get your questions answered. You know, of course, we all had Usenet and news groups and things like that as ways of doing that. But so, you know, set up a meetup, contribute bug reports, contribute pull requests. If you have the ability to translate to another language, contribute translations of the documentation, especially, but also the product itself, probably.
Just a thought on bug reports. Open source programmers, almost as a rule, hate having buggy code. I know it drives me crazy if the code I've put out has problems. But the other issue with this is I only have one or two or three devices to run the code on, and especially if you get into like an Android platform where, you know, there's literally 5,000 different Android devices out there that can run the code. I have no way of testing that on all those devices. And so it is extremely useful to have a whole bunch of people in the community running the code, banging on the code, trying to break the code on their different devices, because things shake out where you find out, oh, well, this is broken because if you're on an Android version X or whatever, you know, it's not going to work the way you thought it did. And there's been multiple times some of my projects we found bugs or problems where it's just, you know, I never encountered it on one of my devices, but, you know, some guy over in Latvia, you know, but runs a different language and found a problem or something. So extremely useful to have people like that in your community.
Yeah. In fact, just to follow up on that, I became involved heavily with the Perl community for that exact reason. I was downloading and running Perl on architectures that Larry Wall didn't have access to. And it's sort of the equivalent. We now call it the Perl 5 porters. But the word porter in there is actually because of they were the people that were in charge of porting it to platforms and access that people weren't aware of. So I became the equivalent of that kind of a tester for Perl 3, which shows how long ago that was. I think it was 1980 or something like that, right? Long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But that's how I got involved. And then I started saying, well, as long as I'm downloading this Perl and playing with it and finding bugs and contributing back to Larry to say, you know, really nice if Perl had this feature. And I actually invented three features in Perl all the way back in Perl 3. So actually, no, one was in Perl 5. But yeah, it was a while ago. But it was fun to be able to chat directly with the lead developer and with the other people who are doing similar things as I was all over the world on a mailing list. And then when Perl 3 finally got released, I was able to answer questions on the mailing list, the public mailing list, so much easier because I'd been banging on it for 6 months and playing with the new features and stuff. And that eventually led to my book deal because somebody had said that the new release of Perl was too complex now. We needed more documentation. And I sort of chimed in and said, well, I'm really familiar with Perl 3 because I was on the team to port it. And also I've been a technical writer for many, many years. I've got a shelf full of books already. And somebody at O'Reilly, same organization that Jono mentioned a few minutes ago, saw that message and said, well, if you're going to write something up, we might as well publish it. And that's how I became a published author. It wasn't by pitching a book idea to hundreds and hundreds of book companies, getting all these rejection letters. The publisher came to me because I was being public. Ah, another advantage of being in the community is that if you want to get hired in the area, having a lot of public commits, public conversations, getting involved in the mailing list, getting involved in Slack channels and doing that, it's going to make it a heck of a lot easier when you finally go approach a company about working for them in this technology, whatever the technology is. So this is sort of a calling card. This is sort of a way to get really, really good. I'm doing that right now with Dart. So I am very active in the Dart and Flutter chat channels, mailing lists, everything, because I want to approach people in the future as a Dart expert. But I'm trying to be very public about it right now. I'm answering questions on Stack Overflow. I'm sitting in the channels for Dart and Flutter all day and really having a great time both gaining my own expertise but also being visible that I'm answering questions more often than not instead of having the questions. So great way to do that. You have anything to say about that?
So that's an interesting thought. Leads to – it's useful to understand how a community communicates or where they hang out, especially if you're an outsider trying to get into it. You know, one of the first things to look at is, you know, what are the different channels of communication? Do they have a Slack chat? Do they have an IRC where the devs hang out? You know, do they do everything in a mailing list? How many mailing? So the Linux kernel obviously has a mailing list, but you're not going to get very far if you just try sending things to the Linux kernel mailing list. That thing has become a beast that no one can tame. but it has its own specific purpose. But that purpose is not for noobs to come ask questions, you know. But you have a project like FWNOP, the one that I'm involved in, and we only have a couple of emails a week on our mailing list, but we respond to those. So that would be a great place to get involved. So that's something that's important, is to kind of understand how the community works as you're trying to get into it, because there's ways that just you'll run into a brick wall, not because and I've seen people, they try to get involved in something and they run into a brick wall and think, oh, well, the community hates me. It's like, well, no, probably not. It's probably just you're trying to communicate in a way that they're not used to, and so they're not doing a very good job of it.
Yeah, speaking of the Linux kernel mailing list, which I have never been a member of, I've been involved with Git since about 3 weeks after it started. It turns out coincidentally that Linus had moved to Portland, and I took him out to lunch. Actually, I think he bought lunch. I still owe him a lunch, I guess. But anyway, so he took me out to lunch, and I asked him, what are you working on? He goes, well, you know, the Linux kernel. I said, yeah, okay. I don't run Linux anywhere. It won't matter to me. And I still don't. My clients all do, but I don't touch Linux. And I'm going to get hate mail. I'm sorry, guys. It's just the way it is. This is a Mac OS laptop, and I have an iPhone. And I don't run an Android. I have an iPhone because I like everything to just work at the end of the day. So, okay, now I'm going to get more hate mail. But let me get to my point. Okay, so I joined the Git mailing list like within – I had to make the tie-in. So he says, well, I've also just started this thing called Git. And I said, what's that about? And he goes, well, you know, we were using – what was the other one that he had for a long time that they lost the rights to? BitKeeper. So that we were using BitKeeper on a free license, not a free software kind of free license, but no-cost license. And that was donated in perpetuity as long as they didn't reverse engineer anything, and somebody reverse engineered it and then are screwed. Anyway, so he says, I'm creating this change control system. I'm calling it Git. And it's just in its infancy, but if you want to play with it, I said, well, does it work on at the time I was running OpenBSD and Mac OS? And he said, why don't you download it and find out? And so I did, and it had some Linuxisms in it. And so I complained to the mailing list. This is a Linuxism. That's a Linuxism. I think this is the equivalent BSD code for that. And I became the canary in the coal mine for many, many years. I would download Git every day and compile it, and I would immediately report things that had snuck in there that were Linuxisms. So that's another way to contribute, by the way, is download and compile the code. Well, it's sort of a continuation of what we've been saying already, which is, you know, get involved with the community. I've never contributed a line of code to the Git project, and yet my name is listed in the credits. I think it's because all the canary stuff that I did for them in the early days. And I felt a little weird about it, because I said, well, this is primarily a Linux project, isn't it? And Linus himself said, no, I want to make sure this is portable. I want to make sure everybody can use this. And so please keep doing what you're doing about saying we snuck a Linuxism in there. So that was really, really fun. Now back to the question about the Linux mailing list. The Git mailing list has always been the catch-all. There is only one Git mailing list. The devs talk on it. Beginners' questions get asked on it. The patches for each new release gets pushed out on it. It is insane. I can't keep up with it anymore. So now they've lost my ability to answer questions for newbies on there. I have to go to places like Stack Overflow and answer Git questions. It's really funny. My most upvoted Stack Overflow question is the question, how do you display the SHA of the head commit? And I just copied it right out of the man page. And it's got like 870 upvotes now. I'm like, guys, stop it. We know that's the answer because it's in the man page. Do you participate in any communities on Stack Overflow?
I use Stack Overflow a lot when I'm searching for information, but I've not been particularly useful to other people there, and that's something I've thought about. I will occasionally answer questions in some other forums, on IRC, but Stack Overflow is not one of the places I've done a whole lot with.
Well, you know what I do is I take my topics and you can get an RSS feed for that keyword, and I drop that into my RSS reader. And so I read through the questions that way real quickly. And if anything looks like a question that I can answer, I immediately go, I pipe through to the actual Stack Overflow and see if it's got a good answer already. And if it doesn't, then I'll contribute my answer. So that's how I get a lot of opportunity to interact that way. So keep in mind you can do that. We're just about to run out of time. So I want to get to the upcoming guests, unless you had anything else you wanted to say before we do that.
So we do have a live chat room as we're sitting here talking back and forth. And someone said something very interesting just a moment ago. Prawn said, avoiding anger in bug reports and sticking to the facts is more effective. And I thought that kind of summed up nicely an important point about building a community. And as generally speaking, just be nice to people and you get better results. It's kind of the same idea as, you know, if you run into a brick wall, don't immediately assume that it's because everybody there are jerks. You know, there's probably just a communication breakdown. Same thing with bug reports. You know, don't raise an angry bug report, raise a nice bug report, and you'll be more likely to get help. It's part of human nature.
Yeah. Well, I hope our audience has appreciated our 15 to 20 minute riff onto our observations about community and open source and things like that. I hope you heard at least a couple good stories in there. But here's what's coming up next. Next week, we have Linkerd, which is a transparent proxy that adds service discovery, routing, and failure handling to your orchestrated system. Just added to the schedule. I'm not exactly sure what this is all about, but it's called Pyrex. Not the type of glass, PYRX. It's virtual screening software for computational drug discovery. Ooh, I hope that's not illegal. That would be bad to have an illegal topic on our show. Anyway, following that is the Open Mainframe Project to increase collaboration across the mainframe community. And yes, people are running Linux on those giant supercomputers. And having Linux means open source, and it means we should cooperate. Process Maker, which is a workflow manager, just also added to the schedule. Scan Code, which scans code. What do you know? But it detects licenses, copyrights, packages, and manifests, and things like that. So that should be pretty interesting as well. We're still filling one or two slots in January. We can always take more guests. In fact, I just had an email just before this show of somebody who's going to be looking at the upcoming dates. So I know we're going to be filling in a few slots. But if you have other suggestions, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My address is on the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We took a number of questions from there. Of course, sometimes the number is zero, but it was greater than zero this time. It's always a number of questions. Yes. Zero is indeed a number. Once I discovered that, I was chuckling at that, yes.
As every C programmer has baked into their brain, yes, zero is an important number.
Yes, yes. Perl as well. Perl starts at zero as well. So you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter, MERLYN. I have a message I have to read. It's still before the end of the year. Coming from the home office. The home office says, what are your favorite segments, shows, or moments on Twit this year? We are putting together our best of episodes and want your help. Head over to twit.tv/bestof, BESTOF. Fill out the form with whatever information you remember and be a part of making these special shows that will air the week between Christmas and New Year's. And that lets me take the week between Christmas and New Year's off, which is very nice. And as I said last week, I did buy a pair of JewelBots, but they haven't gotten to me yet. I think they're actually sitting in Portland right now, so I just might have to get home from this trip, which I will in a week and a half. I'm going to make the Bluetooth talk to my laptop and see what else I can program in, and finally program in C++, as much as I hate that. So that's just like. Anything you want to plug there, Jonathan?
Sure. So I mentioned I talk about the project FWNOT, which is basically a way to do really secure firewalls and then maintain access through those firewalls without giving everyone access. And we are kind of playing with the idea of trying to do a software as a service offering. And so if that's something anyone is interested in, maybe protecting legacy hardware that, for instance, you can only telnet into, but you don't want the entire world to be able to try to telnet into, hit me up, either JP_Bennett on Twitter or jbennett@cypherdyne.com. And let me know if that's something you're interested in. We're kind of in the exploratory phase of putting that together. Some feedback would be great. Trying to build a community around the idea, as we've been talking about.
Yes, yes. Well, very appropriate for this show then. Awesome, awesome. Yes. And Jonathan, thanks once again for being our co-host. You're frequently here and frequently appreciated, so I'm glad you got to do it today.
Wait, I'm not always appreciated when I'm here?
Can I break that one again? Apparently they let anybody do this show because you don't have to know English at all. It's all in binary in my head. It must be it. And Jonathan, always appreciated when you're here.
There you go.
Is that closer? Is that closer?
Yes, that's much better.
But we don't appreciate it if you don't show up. No, just kidding. Now that's even worse. I'm going to stop there. Stop putting my foot in my mouth. And of course, thanks again, Jonathan. We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.